Blog Talk Radio.
This is Jos Ogonige, Will Blue Otter, a 7th grade grandson of Samanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. As Blue Otter, 7th great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt. Friends, this is your co-host, Will Blue Otter. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Blue Otter, 7th great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
Grandfather, teach me the ways of the old, so that I may remember who I am.
Good evening, everybody. This is Blue Otter. Got a special guest tonight. He is a very interesting guy. He's a medical doctor. His name is Bryant Draper, and he's a descendant of Cherokee Nation, also the tribe of Judah, and the Merovingian line of kings. And we're just getting to know Bryant. We met on LinkedIn, and is like, you know, we just immediately clicked, and we've corresponded and talked a little bit, but I think we'll turn before you tell us why you're doing what you're doing. We'll let Mark explain what the Mayan calendar says about what you're doing. So anyway, welcome to the show.
Let's hear it.
Take it away.
Oh, thank
Mark.
You very much.
You ready?
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Oh, didn't know if my mic was on. So, his birth was in the traditional Mayan day count was on a day called Seven Sib, or it's also called the Condor Glyph sometimes, so some condor energy here. And seven is the center of the cycle, so it kind of balances the entire cycle, and that's the cycle of Ok, or dog, so it has things like loyalty, and Quetzalcoatl, Xotl's, dog of the underworld that was his partner, or in some cases his twin, the way it's described. So some of that will be in here. The seven number can relate to a mirroring of both light and dark, and it's associated with also the source accretion or flow of divine will. And people usually with this number tend to have a strong sense of ethics and values and things like that. The Sib or Condor glyph is a glyph that relates to, you know, community, kind of the thought of as the condor energy of the South, the Southern tribes, so kind of power of heart, but also as ability to go into spiritual communion with the you know, spirit world and guides and such. Has the ability to bring about things that have to do with getting different people and groups to come together and go into a state of forgiveness for things going on. Deals, you know, can help with a lot of negativity things, both in the conscious and unconscious realms, in both. So may have found things like that showing up throughout your life. So things about kind of balancing, being in the center of things between light and dark and helping heal and work on things. Probably going to work at your best when you really feel, well, most people would, when, you know, you're feeling kind of going with the divine will of Creator. That's probably when you're at your best, which just common sense. But so those are some of the things. I'm going to switch gears here, go in a little bit into a perspective of your birth from the coming world cycle, looking, and it will have a forwards flow of time, a backwards flow of time, and where these two time flows meet and kind of come together in balance and unity. So in it, on your forward flow of time, it has a lot of things and energy about, and these are things probably you've maybe seen in your life, you may have been, you know, born with, and just skills and abilities you've maybe noticed for a long time. And so the things about being able to focus on things and zero in, strengthening your awareness of things. Again, things are coming up here with polarity, challenges of light and dark, and challenging of that. And things around bringing in sun energy here, life, courage, and the background cycle here, energy of dreaming. So, and maybe you may have found you did really good at dreaming when you were growing up, maybe still now, especially when it clicked up many levels and went up into a universal level, you know, across the universe. So I wouldn't be surprised if you had a lot of interest about stuff like that even when you're growing up. Then on the going backwards, the other time flow going backwards, you have things, and this is things that you may have noticed showing up in your life, you know, the last few years getting stronger and stronger, things since, you know, maybe as far back as 1997. And it's about things about change, synchronizing things, and especially things centered around the movement of things and thought and movement. And brings in aspects here of things that had to do with water and purifying things. A lot there, purification. I hope you talk about the purification day. And so this is especially in probably purification here of thoughts and synchronizing thoughts into the positive realm and moving. So you're probably been getting a lot stronger in doing things like that and helping other people do things like that. Where these two come together, these two time flows come together, create a unity point or a zero point or a bridge between the cycles. And yours is a Hunebku glyph, and that's Mayan, that's creator Hunebku, is said to be the one giver of movement and measure. So that's going back to that thing we just saw a second ago about the thought and movement and such. And it has a... it's saying that what kind of gets you, helps you move through the worlds from one world cycle to the next is things about relating to things and molding things, going into harmony of things. Charity is a key word here. Ascension, ascending, presence of things. But in the background of all that is, again, will, purpose, and discipline, going back into connecting those things back into Creator. So you're going to find, like we said earlier, the thing about going in alignment with Creator here is going to make this, on those particular areas, even stronger. has things in here about equalization of things, balancing things, dynamically doing this. And then you'll probably find that you've been maybe finding things like this even now possibly showing up in your life that are almost, other people would almost consider them almost mystical powers, you know, abilities and stuff. You know, they might categorize it that way. And again, especially seeing those things show up and working when you're clicking and going into unity and really going with the flow of connecting with Creator and working hand in hand there, probably see those powers and abilities really start to take off and become pretty amazing. So, that makes sense?
Absolutely.
Well, from what he told me, it sure makes sense. Now you know why you got eagles and you can call down eagles, and he'll tell you the story, Mark. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, let's see. Let me look for a second, see if we find any eagles here. Give me a second to look around. And I see a jaguar here.
All kinds of medicine animals showing up in his backyard,
I just found it. Yep. The energy that I was talking about since his birth that had to do with focusing and the sun and the dreaming and stuff and the universality and universe, that particular thing has a partner energy, and its partner energy is eagle. And what's interesting about this particular eagle energy is carrying a day number that has to do with it's a universal or universal all number. So I would suspect. That this eagle energy is really leading him up on some very large scales, you know, up at the universal level, not just planetary or solar system, but, I mean, across the universe. So this eagle might be a pretty big eagle.
Yeah.
And it has some partner energy with the eagle that's carrying manique energy, which is the hand. That's the thing with the Lord of the Wind and the Water and the hand Kabul and the symbols in the hand of healing and stuff. So this eagle energy is connecting into that. So it's bringing the healing energy up on a high level.
Well, that's kind of what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
I just got back from Belize, which is very interesting. Let's see. The ruins at the Maiden of the Rock were very, very interesting. My kids were there, and there was such a presence in that area, just west of Belmopan. Actually, the whole country was very interesting. There was a whole different energy down there than there are in, you know, different places in the world. But it was very, very strong, the presence there. It was almost to the point of it almost felt as if there were elders around all the time. There was a Mayan site. We stayed up on one of the northern keys as our base camp. There was a Mayan site on both the northern and southern end of this small island. And one day we had the fortune of going up to the northern end of the island. And we were out with some friend of ours, and we were out by the water. And looking out over the water, we were seeing orbs coming in and out of the ocean, you know, going up into the heavens and coming back down, which is very, very interesting. And it was just very serene. And it'd been like that, you know, when I was younger. I was raised up in the Appalachian Mountains, in the Harlan County area, but actually, you know, we moved back and forth from Southwest Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, and Northeastern Kentucky as a child. My grandfather was in the coal industry, and my mom was very young when she had me. So my grandparents raised me, basically. And my grandmother was a very, very spiritual person, and so was my grandfather. Like, just the most loving people ever. And they taught me a lot of my values early. And they were nothing short of just fantastic, wonderfully warm and cheerful and just helpful people and very charitable. I can remember my grandfather always helping people. You know, he was the kind of guy that, you know, he would give you a shirt off his back, that type of person. He'd go out of his way or walk the extra mile to try to help somebody if they were, you know, less fortunate or if they needed help. You know, having grown up in an Appalachian community, there's a strong sense of community, which is nice. You know, I can remember when I was growing up, it was more so like that in the cities, but more so in the rural areas. And then having that, I had an interesting childhood. You know, I spent time in eastern Kentucky, but I also spent time in the farming areas of western Kentucky with my in-laws around Glasgow, Kentucky, which was wonderful. Again, farming community, large family farm. It was there before the TVA was built, or they were. And my grandfather, where he was born, in the house was actually below the Barron River Reservoir, is where the house is now. So our family farm was actually moved by TVA, and they're still there today. That's the grandfather's side. The grandmother's side was from probably one of the oldest families in eastern Kentucky. They used to be Horde, but then it became Howard. And then before that was Harwarth, which, you know, that goes way, way back, you know, back Middle Ages, et cetera. But, again, very, very devoutly spiritual people. And I actually have a relative that was on that side, the Howards, the Unthanks. And the Unthanks were actually, Nellie Unthank was a Mormon, and she was 1845, was out in Salt Lake at that time. Don't know much about Nellie, but I know that we had a lot of interesting people in our family. And again, strong sense of family, strong sense of together family. And so as a young man, learned a lot of values from them because I watched and I learned. My grandmother's father was a reveneur, which is interesting, an ATF, before ATF was there during Prohibition. And then after that, he became a, how can I explain it? He became a union, some people would call it a union thug. But anyway, he worked as a person that was anti-union when it done the unionization of the mines. Grandpa, that would be on the Howard, that would be grandfather Unthank. And then the other side would be grandfather, my great-grandfather Siddons. He was a physician. He went to Barnes Medical School in St. Louis. Graduated in 1898. He and his brother Fred both went to the two tallest guys in that picture in the 1898 class. And so, you know, he rode around in a buggy, delivered babies in barns, you know, made his own medicines. Didn't have a medical license. I mean, I don't think they had a licensing board per se back then. It certainly had a pharmacy, but there wasn't one very close in eastern Kentucky, I'm quite sure. But he was a well-respected man in the community, had a lot of children. I think there were 13 kids. Grandpa was the youngest, but there were also three wives. So that was a whole story in itself. But again, so I had this great big family. And so not only in eastern Kentucky, but western Kentucky. So I learned rural Appalachia, and then I learned rural like a farming community in central Kentucky when I was younger. And again, we were very active in Baptist church at the time. But grandma always took disciple classes. So we were in church 3 days a week, 4 days a week, which is good. I always enjoyed it. You know, as a young child, you know, I really enjoyed the feeling I got being around community and being around people, or social, which was nice. We visited a lot of people and, again, did a lot of charitable work, you know, going to visit people that were ailing, things like that. I got to meet Grandpa Ben before he passed. I guess he was 96 years old the last time I saw him. And what a wonderful man he was. I can just remember the kindness and peace that was in his eyes. And then that kind of peace that is in the eyes of, you know, all the older people that I learned from back when I was growing up. I always wanted to be like that. But it took a while. I can remember when I was little, during the Vietnam War, my mother had gotten remarried to my stepfather, and we moved to San Antonio, Texas. I had broken my leg. I had a spiral compound fracture of my right leg, and was basically crippled as a young child. You know, I had a full hip spike on the right-hand side. I had to have my, you know, leg built up. I had to learn how to walk again. It was a pretty bad fracture. But I can remember at that time feeling so much comfort just because I could go into, I guess it would be I had imaginary friends, and or my mom said I had imaginary friends, but I would see, I could see things from the time I was young. And so I always thought that they were imaginary. Mom would call them imaginary friends. Other people would call them imaginary friends. But to me, I could actually see things. And I could see these light orbs, I guess you would call them. And these orbs were around. And they gave me such a sense of peace and comfort because they were my friends. They would always be there. I could look up in the sky or I could look across. If the light was right or if the situation was right, I could look up and there'd be this big round orb somewhere. And I'd always, you know, it'd have a face in it. And sometimes it would have a hood or it'd have a face with a hood with a beard or whatever. And, you know, they would always smile and I'd smile back and then be there and they'd be gone or they'd show up again. But they were around. But I always was afraid to tell people about these things when I was a kid because, you know, most time when people said they were seeing things, people thought they were a little kooky. Some people might think that way still. But, you know, there's a separate reality out there. And the point being that, you know, as I grew up, I lost that because I was socialized out of that through my schooling. I guess that's the best way to say it. I grew up with a very thick accent, and then I moved up into the D.C. area. And then I was told that, you know, having this Kentucky accent, it sounded a whole lot like Cockney, old British Cockney. The way they talk, you don't move your jaw, you speak real fast, you slur your words together. And then, you know, I had always been very interested in caves and caving and things like that when I was younger, as I was growing up in that area. And I straddled between D.C. and Eastern Kentucky because I spent a lot of time when I wasn't in D.C. back in Eastern Kentucky at Grandma and Grandpa's house. And Grandpa was in the coal mining industry, so of course there are a lot of caves around. Especially being a geologist, we did a lot of backtracking on an old international scout 4x4. I can remember driving way up on these ridges where you know be 1,000-foot drop off on one side and 800 feet on the other side, and we'd be straddling these little logging roads, and Grandpa would be out checking for rocks. He had a Geiger counter; he always checked with him too. But he would be prospecting, looking for coal seams, looking for minerals, and blah blah blah. We would find these caves. We'd go in these caves, and there would be these strange writings in them. We would find, today I know them as Celtic runes. Some of them we would find Hebrew writing in them, and even Phoenician, which is kind of interesting. As I've grown older, I recognize this now. To validate this a little bit, there's a thing that in northeastern Tennessee they call the Bath Stone. That's written in Phoenician, and I've seen that writing in caves before in Eastern Kentucky. But again, these are obscure places way off the beaten track that you basically have to take a four-wheel drive to get into and find these things. There's also a thing called the Ogham writings, which are in Clay County, Kentucky, also in southern, I guess there's some in southern Ohio. I've actually seen the ones in Clay County. There's more than one. And again, they're Celtic runes, which are interesting. I've seen them firsthand, and they say on this day Christ was born. This is one Southern Celtic, which is pretty neat. But there's also Hebrew that I've seen down there in some of the caves, or what appears to be Hebrew letters. I'm not quite sure because it's been a while. Also, I was very young and I haven't been back up in that area. But we used to go when I was young, as well as when I was in my early college years, because I went to college in Eastern Kentucky in a small school in Barberville. And, you know, one of our pastimes was I was in a caving club, and and there's a lot of caves in Eastern Kentucky. There are some caves that you can go in one county and come out next county over 25, 30 miles of passageways. A lot of limestone there. And, again, all sorts of neat formations, crystals, energy sources, and again, a lot of writings and artifacts. And getting to the next point, we would always, go out and look after fields had been plowed, and we would find these areas where the Native Americans had lived. And Kentucky was a happy hunting ground. So I think the area was shared by a lot of different tribes, at least from what my findings have been during my life. We always would find these very interesting, snap points. We'd find an area where there was a toolmaker. Of course, there'd be a lot of flint around. We would find gorgets, beaver tails. I mean, old points mixed with new woodland era points. But the interesting thing is we would find red shirt, we'd find obsidian points, we would find blue shirt or bluish-grayish shirt, sometimes quartz. And so it showed a lot of trade, which was the interesting part. And the interesting thing is that we paired up with a professor when I was at Union College, named Ron Rosenstiel. And the, part of the Appalachian Wilderness Club. And he was a Native American. And enter my first wife, who, her name was Reba. She passed away in 1998, unfortunately. But she was, her great-grandfather was a man named Nelson Rose, who was a Cherokee out of Etowah, Georgia, and they had come off the Trail of Tears. And we sparked as soon as we saw each other. We lived together for 11 years before we got married. We were basically love at first sight type of thing. We were inseparable. But we did a lot of this together. And we had the good fortune of when we paired up with Ron got Reba. Ron was had a way of getting people with the Native American scholarships. And so Reba ended up getting a scholarship to go to school based on her lineage and her blood. I never really looked into it. I don't know why. But it was an interesting thing where we got a chance to learn about our culture in Eastern Kentucky and learned about the Trail of Tears, learned about how a lot of the people that left Etowah had gone up over the ridges and were actually spread out in that area way before the Trail of Tears ever happened. I didn't realize that, at the time that there was a man named Elias Boudinot who had a complete, a Cherokee newspaper, and there was this huge culture that was actually preexistent before the settlers even got here. This was a little bit more advanced. But, I learned a whole lot, and the knowledge was coming quick. And again, it was being validated by finding these different things all over Eastern Kentucky where we wandered, in our youth, which was actually a lot of fun. So fast forward a little bit. Ron started doing some work with University of Kentucky with a man named Ron Eller, who wrote Miners, Millhands, and Mountaineers, and also a guy named Jess Wilson, who was a poet. There's another guy up there who was a writer named Gurney Norman, who wrote Divine Ridge Trip. We learned a whole lot about these interesting characters from Eastern Kentucky. That was all spurred on in academia, which is really nice, because we had these professors who weren't door closers, they were gate openers. They're like, you know what, keep going with that. Keep following that. See what you're going to find. Keep seeking. And the whole time we were developing our own, our own spirituality, which would be more along the lines of medicine wheel at that time. We were learning about it, and again, we had these wonderful people that were opening doors for us and saying, explore, look, keep looking, you're going to find something. And we did, which is very interesting. So Ron was doing some work. They were finding these I guess they were Native American burials. We didn't really, you know, we didn't do the work of actually the reburial part, but they would find, people would come and say they'd find a bone sticking out of the ground, and it would end up being a Native American burial site. But the neat thing that we were finding was, is there were these artifacts that were like, we would find turquoise in these graves. There was silver in these graves. We weren't doing excavations, University of Kentucky was. And the most incredible thing was, is they were finding these big carved stone heads like you would find in Central America. And these things were 3 to 4 feet tall. And they were carved glyphs of what, now that I've been to Central America, they were pictures of things that I would find, let's say, at the Maiden of the Rock, in any of the big temples down there. So there was definitely this big trade network of indigenous people at the time that I was growing up. I was realizing this, and it was always getting validated by these finds. When we would go out, we would find, you know, we weren't finding Clovis points, but we were finding stuff that was that old, or just before the area of what we would call Clovis area. So there were, you know, we called them paleo points. We would find these big, crude paleo points, you know, about the size of your hand, and then we'd find very small, you know, bird points from woodlands. And they would be in the same area. So it validated to us, and people have been coming here for a long time to hunt.
Are you familiar with the Salutrian points?
Sir, I can't hear you.
Are you familiar with the Salutrians?
Salutrians.
Yes,
I am. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. It looks kind of like the badge that the early Star Trek in the 60s those guys wore. Similar to that, they're saying that was the predecessor to the Clovis point because of the point that was found in.
Oh yeah, we found those. We found those in eastern Kentucky. Actually, we used to find these beaver tails, too. I don't know if you know what that looks like. They would have turkey tail, and then they had beaver tail points. And then, yes, those Salutrian points, yes, we find those. And again, what was interesting is that we would find these ceremonial pieces, too, occasionally. You know, we would, these gorgons, beautiful. You're familiar with what a gorgon is, correct? Something you wear around your neck. Okay. Well, we were finding things. We also found a lot of pipes, which is cool, too. You know, hand-carved pipes. Not so much the ceremonial. They wouldn't be like soapstone ceremonial stuff like you'd find in the West, but they would be pipes made out of quartz, which was interesting because indigenous quartz pipes are not, you don't find those in that area, you know? So, again, it just showed that there was a lot of trade in the area, and there was a large, vast network when tribes were united, and they all, you know, they came in and freely hunted, you know, with each other, helping each other out as a community. They traded freely between Central America or whatever. You know, I think the Aztecs kind of started up in Wisconsin and moved down with the seasons. That's kind of my spin on things.
I've been to that place up in Wisconsin where the Aztec State Park.
Okay.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's interesting.
So, you got these mound builders, you know, and you got pyramids, you know, here in the United States, which is interesting. And again, it just shows that there was this, it's been civilization's been there a long time. I mean, let's look down here in Vero Beach, Florida. Just recently, they found a 13,500-year-old mammoth bone with a picture of a mastodon carved into it just recently at a dig site there. And again, I guess this would be Salutrian. And they also found on some more mammoth bones there, they found a picture of a man with a spear in his hand and a picture of what appears to be a shark or maybe a megalodon or something. But they were out there fishing. And again, you know, that was at a time, you know, that blows away Lascaux Caves, by the way. It almost doubles their dating, and it's here in Florida, which is interesting. And then you've got the mound building cultures here in Florida on the West Coast. Let's go out to Shell Mound. Who knows how old Shell Mound is? I mean, that's a mound of oyster shells. that's been built up over who knows how many years and how long people were on the western coast of Florida. So, again, going back to civilizations here in the United States, you know, we've got evidence of Phoenicians, Hebrew, Celts, the Seleucidian peoples. I mean, we could go on ad infinitum with concrete and tangible evidence is basically what I'm looking at saying. It's been happening. So let's kind of move on further in my life. So I always had an interest in helping people. You know, when I was in college, I had this great, just wonderful opportunity called to take this thing called the Appalachian Semester, where you take a whole semester during your junior year of college, and you go out and spend time doing service work in Appalachia, which is awesome. I got to work out in a place called Craig's Creek Survival Center, which is, you know, a less fortunate area, like there's a lot of less fortunate areas, as people would call them, even though people are fortunate. It's just there's no industry and there's no job. That's what it comes down to because it's so isolated. But it was called the Craig's Creek Survival Center, and it was a handball place. And, you know, they would get these government subsidies and hand them out to people who couldn't afford diapers and blah, blah, blah. But we got to do service work there. And then I did my internship in a small hospital in Eastern Kentucky. So I got to see southern, or let's say, I wouldn't say southern, because it's not really southern. I'd just say in neutral territory, Kentucky territory. I had to see how healthcare worked. And it was amazing to see how the community came together to make it happen, because there wasn't a lot of funds. And you had a lot of wonderful physicians down there that really gave their hearts to people to help them, to make things happen, because there wasn't the funding that you would have in a large place, which, you know, healthcare wasn't rationed. It was freely given. I guess that's a better way to say it. And the people did the best they could with what they had, which was really the best part about it. You know, and they came together as a team. And there wasn't no I in that team, which we find difficult in some places at this point in the healthcare game, or at least what I see now from where I am in that whole picture. So it was an interesting thing. So let's fast forward up to about 22 years old. Reba and I are having this great time. I go on this trip to Maine, and I guess it was July 3rd, 1989. I'm sitting in the middle of this big open field in Maine with her. I don't think she was on the trip, but I was in Maine in July 3rd of 89. And I look up into the heavens, and then, boom, the orbs started coming down. And I was like, whoa, am I seeing things? No, you're not seeing things. I, like, pinched myself, you know. And this was something I remember seeing when I was a kid, which is neat. And I can remember what a sense of peace and happiness it was. And, you know, that whole, I didn't want to believe it because it was almost, I like to call it so real, not surreal, because it was so real that it was happening. But some people would say it's surreal because to some people that don't have that kind of belief or faith, they would say it would be surreal, but I call it so real because it was so real. I was like, wow, this is very real. And it was very, very comforting to know that the Creator is out there and it's all around us all the time. We just don't see it. It's right in front of our nose. The Spirit, the Presence, whatever you want to call it, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to say it, the Father, the sky, the moon, the earth, the Spirit is there. That's an easy way to say it, the Great Spirit. So, you know, having learned about the medicine wheel and having learned some about spirituality from different points in the world at that time, because I gathered a little bit from everywhere because I was always searching for that, trying to figure out what that hole was in my life that needed to be filled, you know. Felt like there was something missing. I didn't have that spirit. I like to call it the spiritual angle. And so I looked at it from the Buddhism point of view, and then I looked at it from the Christianity point of view. I looked at it from Taoism. I looked at it from, you know, just different ways of looking at it from around the globe through different eyes, Rastafarianism, you know, Mayan, you know, just different ways and different systems of belief. And what I found out, they're all pretty much the same. Because I always looked at the commonality of it, not how they were different. How are all these things the same, and why do all these different wonderful people from around the world all have this commonality between them? Well, it's pretty simple. We all have one heart, and we all have one mind if we make it like that. And the power of that, all having one heart and one mind, is what brings peace, what brings mercy and love to the world. And it's the separation of people and looking at first thing to do is to judge somebody instead of saying, I'm just like you. How can we help each other instead of we're different and I'm going to have more than you or I'm going to take your share? I guess that's the way that I started to view life from about the age of 22. But again, it took me a while because I was at that nirvana part, you know, you get up in that crown chakra and you get all this, what we call kundalini going on. You're like, whoa, hey, it was way too much information coming in too fast from up in the sky. And it's hard to take it all in because when I make a connection with the Great Spirit, it's like all this knowledge comes to me. I don't know what to do with it. You know, I'm like, whoa, I want to go dancing around and say, wake up, all these great things are happening. And people are like eating their cereal looking at you like, huh, what? You're nuts, you know? Which is kind of what I found out when I was talking to the Mayan folks down in Belize. They're like, you know, people are sweet. It's hard to wake people up. They don't want to be awake. They get caught up in what we call the obsessions of the mind or the ego. Or I guess we would say it this way. There's an old saying called resting on your laurels, okay? So when you rest on your laurels, you're proud of the achievements that you have and you got to the crown chakra for a second and you're good. You don't need to keep seeking. One of those things is staying conscious contact with the Creator. It's the hardest way, the easiest way to say it, staying in conscious contact with our Creator, our universal Creator, our one love. Now, I can't get enough of that. And again, I've learned, and it took me a while to learn how to balance it like you were talking about, because there is no good or bad, it just kind of is. Everybody wants love, no matter what realm they are. You know, the whole thing you're talking about with the animal thing, it took me, let's see, I had a spiritual awakening at 22. Then I had a really big one when I was 33 years old. That's when my wife and child died. That's when I really felt the nearness of my Creator. I was in so much pain. Reba died from complications of the pregnancy. I lost her and my firstborn son. They both died in my arms. And at that time, I was in such pain. And that's the first time that time and space ever got suspended in my life. And it was the most, it was like I was floating. And I never had felt that way before. Now, I've had that kind of thing happen since then. But that's kind of when I really kind of got woken up. It was like, hey, there's a bigger purpose out there. I know you're in pain, but we're here to comfort you. And there was a presence in that room that was there to comfort me. Because, you know, everybody has their own destiny. And it's very hard to change that if you're another person looking in from the outside. But when you're looking in from the inside, you understand that destiny is something that's, you know, the Creator has a grand design. And you know, we're here to follow, you know, the directions of our Creator. And, you know, it took me a while to understand that. And I lost my grandfather. I didn't lose him. He wanted to go be perfect. Well, he passed, and this is the interesting thing. He died on March 18th. Reba the baby died on July 18th, and my grandmother died on September 18th. All of them died in my arms, basically, which is tough at the time because I was mourning flesh, and I wasn't celebrating their soul going on to be perfect. But it took a wise person to come to me, and again, this is a member of my family, and hold my hand and say, you know something? Ever think that maybe you were the person that was supposed to be there when they went off to be perfect? And wow, did that click. I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't think about that. And every one of them died smiling, and they were reaching, which is the beautiful part about it. And we'll talk about it in a second as I go into looking in the emergency room. So, you know, I went on with my studies in my life to want to be a physician. And, boy, that was an interesting deal. I went from UK. I ended up going to school in the Caribbean, which for my first 2 years, which was interesting. I didn't want to play politics of mommy and daddy giving lots of money to a hospital, library, charity fund. I didn't have that. I wanted to be a self-made person, so I just said, hey, man, I saw this little tag on the wall for a good school in the Caribbean. Take these classes, get a decent score on this or whatever. And, you know, all the planets lined up, and boom, I was in the Caribbean. I sold everything I had, went down there with a backpack, and lived like the locals did on the island of St. Lucia for a couple years, doing my basic sciences, learning British medicine, which was, you know, physical diagnosis and old school, old world medicine, which was really, really fortunate to learn it that way, because, you know, you really rely on your physical diagnosis there, and got into the basics the British way, which is very neat. Plus, I got to live like the locals did in a Caribbean island, you know, learn how to speak Patois, learn how to live off the bush, and learn their spirituality of the islands, too, which was neat, which was they were called Obi, or, you know, they have their own way of looking at the spirit. And this is from African tradition that's mixed with tradition of, you know, the Eastern Indian slave, which would be the... it's a mixture of African and then East End, or people from India when this was a colony of Britain. They called St. Lucia the Helen of the West, which had Spanish, African, French, and English all had owned the island at one time. It was a sugarcane island and a banana plantation type place. And so there's a mixture, and Dutch too. And so you had a mixture of all these different languages and spirituality all mixed into one. And again, they would speak this what we would call Patois, or, you know, kind of, if you've been to Haiti or any place, they'd call it Creole or Quail. But I learned from them, and I lived with them, and I lived like them, and I lived amongst them, and I was accepted amongst them, which was even bigger being from the States, because not a lot of people are accepted because of their arrogance being from the States and their unteachability, I guess you would call it. Because I've always wanted to be a student. I was eager to learn. So I went down there and I learned what it was like to be, you know, a part of, and looking at the commonality, not apart from, not I'm better than you, I'm from the States. No, I'm one of your brothers. Can I be a part of? And they were like, yeah, come on. And so I would go into what we would call shanty town, which is no different than going into a coal camp in eastern Kentucky and breaking bread with good people, and sharing, you know, stories, commonality. But the beautiful thing was, is while I was down there, they showed me all of their indigenous culture while I was there. They had been there before them, the Arawaks, the Caribs. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, I'm out on the side of this volcanic cone they would call the Pitons, and about 15 feet of water, snorkeling, and guess what? There's glyphs there. I'm like, whoa, I've seen these before in eastern Kentucky. And these glyphs are, you know, once again, guess what? It's Phoenician, which is interesting. Here I am in the Southern Caribbean, and I'm looking at these Phoenician writings in 15 feet of water. And this isn't any Caribbean. This looks like old Phoenician writings, old second. There's three different styles of Phoenician, first, second, and third. I can't remember what they call them. They're like different eras of developing letter or numeric systems. And there they are, sitting in 15 feet of water. And they're like, this is what the Arawaks used. I was like, well, man, that might have been a little older than the Arawaks. Or maybe the Arawaks knew how to do this. I don't know. I don't know what came first, but I can just tell you what I saw with my eyes. And then trekking up into, it was just rainforest. And so the local people would say, well, these are the places where the spirits live. And there would be caves. And we'd walk up into those caves, and again, lo and behold, there would be, you know, these old ancient glyphs in there. Some of them were just like you would see in Aboriginal glyphs, or what you would find in the what we call Anasazi style in the Southwest, how to pick the glyphs, and they would be in these caves, and they would be afraid to go in there because of what they would say, the spirits. But, you know, me being a courageous person hey, man, I'm all about checking this out. I'd walk right in there. And, of course, I wouldn't feel any negative energy. All I felt was good energy in there, because I think it has a lot to do with, I guess this is what you would see in a Christian Bible, like the beget thing. If you fear something, you're going to beget fear. So if you walk in with love, you beget love. And no matter what the spirit is there, it feels the love, so it's going to love you back. I think that's the way it works. Or at least that's what I've been finding. Because if something appears to the face on the outside to be, let's say, negative, it's just needing love, too, on the inside. So that's why I said there's really no good or bad. It just is. And it's all about one love, no matter what the mind wants to judge. That's what I've been learning in my life, which is kind of neat, the commonality of everything. And that's the balance that you talk about, the zero point. And it's difficult to get there sometimes, because the first conscious thought the mind wants to have is to judge, is to separate, which is kind of the bondage of self that they would call in Christianity. Okay? There's a guy that wrote a book named Gary Zukav, Z-U-K-A-V, called The Seat of the Soul. And it talks about, his main proponent is teaching people how to live by spiritual principles, which is very neat. Because, you know, in medicine we say, see one, do one, teach one. And I think that's kind of the tradition of many of the elders in history is, once they saw it, then they did it, and then they taught it, because they got from the experience. They learned that that's what worked. And that's what kept them in conscious contact with their creator, which is kind of neat. Because these ancient, you know, oral traditions, be it indigenous U.S., be it indigenous Afghanistan, be it indigenous Iran, or wherever you are and looking at the stars, you're really in the same spot. You're just moving at a little, you're in a different spot on the same planet, moving at the same speed around this beautiful universe we have. And really what it comes down to, it's just, that's the universal creator. If you look at the Kabbalah, the word for the highest deity is Ein Sof, and it's German, E-I-N-S-O-P-H, that means one love. Kind of interesting how that works. And also, there are different names for the same deity, which would be A-Y-I-N-I-N, which is nothingness, which is the presence. It's kind of like the Force in Star Wars. That's the presence or the spirit. It's always there. It's around. You can tap into it if you are in tune. And again, that kind of goes back to, this is such a kitschy thing to say. It's all about source and frequency. Because it is all about source and frequency. Where you are and what wavelength you are. And again, it has a lot to do with the emotion and if you're caught up in the bondage of self. So how do you get there? A lot of people ask. Well, let me just tell you a couple anecdotes about when I was working in Detroit, Michigan. I worked in a trauma hospital. I was fortunate enough to train underneath. The man started emergency medicine as a specialty. His name was Ron Crum, and what a wonderful man he was. He passed away a few years ago. He was a mentor to me and more like a father figure to me, because Ron was just one of those super-duper beings that was just full of love. All he ever wanted to do was teach people and be good to people. You know, our patient population in Detroit would be judged by most people as less than. You know, we were just a team of people trying to do the best we could with what we had in an inner city hospital, which at the time was what some people would call a war zone. You know, a lot of gunshot wounds, a lot of IV drug users, you get to see where society's downfall is. The people that you throw away in society end up coming to a larger hospital, like receiving hospital in Detroit. But you know something, those are some of the best people that ever teach you, because they're honest and they really want medical care, and you're doing your best to learn. It's probably one of the best academic institutions for emergency medicine in the state, Spokane is. And what a bunch of wonderful people we had there. We had Charles Lucas and a Ledgerwood. You know, these people are just super duper smart people that were just totally giving of their heart to people. And the stories that would come out of there were, you know, the stories, you know, the doctors would break down in these parts of town that were like gang ridden, and the gang members would come up in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. and go, "Hey, can we help you out? You took care of me when I got shot," you know. And that's the kind of relationship that we had with, you know, the people that lived on the streets and in the streets, and also the community that was around the hospital. You know, they trusted us, and from that we learned. And they taught us what it was like to live that kind of life and made us appreciate life for what it is a lot more. But anyway, Ron, you know, full of wisdom, always would teach us that to be patient, to be understanding, to be tolerant, and most importantly, to be kind and give love always. No matter what frame of mind you're in, no matter how much chaos was around you, to always bring peace. Bring peace to everything. Because that's the way, that's just the way of a healer. And again, he didn't call it a doctor, he called it a healer. Somebody heals from chaos to bring peace. And I think that's the point, is that when there's chaos, if we just put our mind and our hearts together, peace comes. So, again, that was a very spiritual experience. That was when I learned the power of healing in the hands, of actually laying hands on somebody, you know, the human touch. You know, there's an electricity in the human body. Some people call it chakras. Some people call it deep healing, maybe. But some people have this gift that they can lay hands on people and they actually heal them. And base healing, they call it in Southeast Kentucky. You know, they got the guys that dance with snakes in their hands. Sometimes they get bit, sometimes they don't. You know, Eastern Pentecostals, we call them. We have those down in Eastern Kentucky. And we also have people that speak in tongues and, you know, get filled with the Holy Spirit, basically. And, of course, shamans have done that through the centuries. I got to see that without the whole ritual. On more than one occasion, I've seen people be clinically dead and just wake up and go, "Whoa, I'm back." And much to the people around you don't want to believe that that was a miracle that just happened. And again, you've seen all these books out in the literature about people that have died and come back to life. I've seen it happen. I've seen a lot of people pass away too. And the beautiful part of it, most of them are reaching and smiling when they're passing. People call that posturing sometimes. It's not posturing. They're reaching for something. And I know what they're reaching for because I can see what they're reaching for, which is the orbs, which is kind of cool. So, again, that validated that I was not going out of my mind. but I started seeing these things again as orbs, which came back after my faith got, I guess I would say my faith got reaffirmed from being around a man who was kind with a big heart, and that would be Dr. Krum. And I can't thank him enough. I'm so grateful. You know, I guess the best way to say it is I'm just so grateful to be breathing right now. That's the best part, and to be a part of this beautiful creation. So let's move forward a little bit. You know, after Reba passed, you know, again, there was a lot of self-pity, and so that blocked me off from, I guess you would call this on my dear spirit. That's the best way to say it. Because when I have, and I can only speak from my own experience, when I find myself in times of either self-pity or grandiosity, which are both sides of what we would call pride, okay, because you can have too much pride and you can have too little pride. It's a 0 point that you're talking about, the balance. You know, grandiosity is, "Hey, I did this, look at me," and self-pity is like, "Oh, poor me." You know, I guess that's the best way to describe that. To stay in the middle of that and just to be okay with who I am, where I am, is kind of the point. I'm okay. I don't need outside validation. I have a relationship with my Creator that's the perfect love. And even though I may not perfectly love my Creator perfectly loves me back. It forgives me because I'm human. I make mistakes. Do I make as big of mistakes as I used to? I try not to. Sometimes I don't see big mistakes that I make, but I do the best I can. And I think the Creator knows that. And as long as I'm patient, understanding, tolerant, kind, and do things with the intention. And again, I think it goes down to motive. What is the heart's motive? The motive is love. The motive is kindness, not what can I make off this person? What can I get out of this? No, what can I put into this? You know, just turning around. I like to call it turning it over. You know, if I feel that selfish or the bondage of self coming in, well, wait a second, I'm feeling a little disturbed. That's the cool part about self-examination. I learned that through the Jesuits. And again, they do that in Buddhism too, you know, the Dalai Lama, listening to him with these tenets of Buddhism. You know, it's all about looking at the self. And Buddha even said, the self is the enemy. I do a conscious or spiritual study because I can't get enough of it now. So if I can be relieved of the bondage of self in the moment, that's kind of keeping me with the flow of the universe. And when that creative flow happens, guess what? I get inspiration. It's a recipe. If you just do the recipe, I call it the universal law of cause and effect, or instant karma. If I'm going with the flow, and the flow from the creator is coming into me, my thinking is on a level of divine inspiration, which is kind of neat. It's actually quite humbling to say, wow, that beautiful nothingness that's out there is flowing through me right now. And you can get, I would call that white kundalini. You get spiritually intoxicated, which is, again, can make it a little crazy sometimes. In the sense that it's hard to order your thoughts. And some people might call that ADD, but it's not ADD. It's just got so many brilliant things running through your mind that you can't put them all down fast enough because you're being programmed from out there instead of being programmed from down here. Because the mind works a lot like a computer. And that's what I've been finding out. The mind is a two-way thing, like a transistor radio. Most people just receive, well, we can transmit. That's kind of neat, too. The brain we have can be programmed through socialization. If you miss out on spirituality when you're younger, you miss out on the transmission part because prayer is raising your heart to God or raising your heart to the Creator, whatever you want to say it. Or some people have trouble with the spiritual angle. I would say, well, what are the seven things you want your God to be? And they'll list all these things, and I said, well, that's your God. Pray to that. And they're like, wow, that's an easy way to remember that. My God can be loving, kind, forgiving. Yeah, that's God. That's just a little bit of it, though. That's not all of it. You know, like, I don't want to give them a big secret, but it's just everything. But that gives people something to believe in when they don't believe, which is kind of neat. Which is really neat because then they start praying. And then meditating is listening. That's a skill. It's hard to sit still and keep your mind open because guess what? When their creative force talks back, wow, now that's humbling. And what's even more humbling is when either you get a direct inspiring thought or you get creativity, which is neat. Out the lights flashing all around me outside right now, which is kind of neat too. I'm out under the stars beneath the moon. It's beautiful out. Clear, crickets chirping, peaceful. But I got flashes and a light all around me right now, which is neat. So let's kind of move forward a little bit. So, I got into the whole medicine gig. I've done a lot of medicine. I got kind of burned out working in the emergency room. One of my colleagues passed away in 2009, who was a very dear close friend of mine. And I just kind of got burnt on emergency room care, because you do, because you get the tragedy, bringing peace all the time is very draining on the soul. Although I would go back to it again, but right now, it's just at the time, it wasn't the time to do it because it was affecting my family life because I was, doing this crazy commuting and just overextending myself. And that's the other part about spirituality. You got to stay balanced, like you said. I was overextending myself in the physical and the body instead of working on the spiritual, because there's an old saying that once the spiritual malady is overcome, the body and the mind, or the mind and the body straighten out, which is kind of the truth. I lost a spiritual connection when I was overworking because, again, I was, not spending my time in balance is the best way to say that. I was too worried about money at the time. And it's funny on the money it says in God we trust. because if you're doing the right thing, it just kind of comes to you. You get what you need, not what you want, always. And you get what you need to help others as much as you can, too, as long as you're doing it, which is kind of neat. So, let's see. Now, or where I am today, because there's a lot more in there, and I could talk for a long time, and that's probably not something that's good to do at this point. Maybe we can do this again sometime. But the big picture is that, you know, there's a connection. It's there. I see it. I feel it. And now I hear it, which is even more beautiful. And again, I couldn't hear it for a while. And I guess that would be in the Christian, the ear to hear, or hearing the Great Spirit, or whatever, hearing the inner self, you know, whatever you want to say from around the world. But when you talk to the Great Spirit and you listen, he talks back, which is kind of neat. And what he says might surprise you, because he has a sense of humor. Or she.
Yeah.
How you look at it. What's that?
Yeah.
I hear you laughing. You got something to say, Will? Well, again, there's this.
I'm just kind of speechless. I'm sitting here going, oh, my gosh, she has had a lot of the same experiences I had with losing my wife and all the spiritual things that happened. But I'm here to tell you, when you meet and talk with Dr. Charles Rogers, mm-hmm. I mean, you guys went to medical school, both went to medical school in the Caribbean, both worked in a lot of the same places, did a lot of the same things, learned medicine the same way, and you're going to have a very rewarding experience with Dr. Rogers. I just can't wait.
Experience with you too, my brother.
Oh no! You don't understand. You will. You'll understand soon.
All right.
Because all those mentors that you had when you were younger, I'm not going to say anymore. You're going to meet an amazing person.
I love it. There's not a bad thing in this world. It's all just beautiful. It's all how you look at it. You know, one of the nice things is you're talking about the animal totem. You know, I get up early, about 4 a.m. on purpose, because it's a time when there's peace out, when there's, you know, a lot of people, or the group consciousness of the area, most people are in dream time at that time. They're REM sleeping. So these beautiful animals come out at that time of the night because, number one, they're not afraid. And then, number two, it's quiet and peaceful for them. So, you know, it's not and I live in Central Florida, and I'm seeing coyotes here. I had two of them sitting in my mom's driveway the other night, which was just a beautiful thing. And they weren't afraid. They were very friendly. You know, most coyotes are very wary. These guys are like, they look like they were trained. They were sitting on their haunches up there, you know, smiling. They weren't afraid of us either, which was the best part. And we just walked right by them and said, oh, peace. And they were like, you know, all good. We're just chilling out here watching your house for you, which is kind of neat because they look like they're a garden place. And then, you know, there's such a plethora of wildlife coming back to Central Florida. Sandhill cranes, I see them all the time. That's unheard of. Bald eagles, got them all over the place here. Black eagles. Swallowtail kites, peregrine falcons, man. You haven't seen some of those in a while. Black eagles, gold eagles. And again, some people call them buzzards. It's really American condor. And you're right, condor is my totem. If you look at my name in hieroglyphics, I have a condor at in the one of the lower positions between the two signs of water. The water sign is at the beginning and the end of the hieroglyphic reading. And it's funny that you say that, because if you look at the root of the word unthank, it's un-ankh, or one-ankh, A-N-K-H, which was French. That came from the Egyptian root, or one-ankh, which means one life, which is kind of neat. And again, we can trace our family roots quite far back. But my gut feeling is that man's been in North America a lot longer than 13,500 years.
try 17, at least 17,000, at least.
Well, I'm thinking more along the lines of 30.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking over on the other side. I'm thinking on the other side of the world, maybe as far as 100,000 over in India and areas.
They're finding when they find an old boot in a coal mine in gravel that hasn't been exposed for a million years. You know, any rabbi will tell you that this earth has been destroyed and coalesced and come back together many times. It's one of the
at this point, if you look at the prophecies, it's probably six times and we're going on to seven before it becomes perfect. That's usually the cycle.
We got to go through the 11 curtains, you know, between us and the throne it's amazing. You've walked in a lot of places that I have and covered a lot of the same territory. But I got to say, you've made it further because because of my circumstances the last few years, I've really kind of lost touch with the earth, and I need to get out and start doing ceremony again. I've just been I was disabled. I had a in 94. Well, in the early mid 80s, I started. My wife started telling me I was snoring real bad and stopping breathing at night, and I had a sleep test, and they did surgery on me in 85. But by 94, I couldn't sit for more than 20 minutes without my lips turning blue and falling asleep.
The sleep apnea is kind of terrible.
I gained 200 pounds, and Dr. Rogers explained to me, you know, when you're that sick, you know, you go for the food that gives you energy because you're not sleeping. It was just setting me up. I was headed into the military in 72 and 73. When I heard in 1994 when the pulmonologist told me, well, did you ever have a head injury because you've got central sleep apnea? I said, yeah. I said, I was hit by a 2.5-ton truck doing 55 miles an hour, you know, when I was sitting still on the freeway in a traffic jam outside of Knoxville. And he says, well, you know, that's what did it. But had that accident not happened, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today. The Creator literally had to sit on me to make sure I'm doing what I'm doing. Just been living hand to mouth like a monk, basically, you know.
You just said a key word there, Knoxville. So did you grow up around Knoxville?
Well, I'm in Crossville now. My parents.
You were right in Crossville. Okay.
Yeah, they were planning on retiring to Oak Ridge. My dad's first job was at the dam, over here near Clinton.
TBA? Norris?
Norris, yeah. And the second job was down with the Corps of Engineers in Mississippi. They built Camp McCain, and he married the boss's daughter.
Oh, nice.
And my grandpa worked on the Mississippi River with the Mississippi River Commission, and they were huge gardeners and very spiritual people. My dad's people were immigrants, you know, from Sweden and Germany, and so I just had a very eclectic upbringing, you know, bounced all over the place, I've had kind of an interesting life, and because I've done a lot of traveling and been bounced around a lot, and like you, I lost a wife, and that year before and the year after, it's just an unbelievable the way the veil opened up I've heard things and I've been told things. I was told in 82 that my wife was going to die during the dark of the moon, and 13 years later it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told in 98, you know, what the weather was going to be like in 2005, you know, but I don't have the same manifestations you do. If I were a rabbi, I would say you are what they call a tzaddik. And I'm you're the kind of a guy you have so much energy coming in, you got to wear a hat.
That's right.
Yeah, and literally so. Yeah, and yeah, it's amazing.
Hard to write it all down. It really is. It's amazing the amount of stuff that comes, and I'm just constantly learning, and it's hard to shut off sometimes, which is interesting because so much creativity is out there, and it wants to come here, but there's so many people just eating cereal, sleep, watching TV, you know.
Right. That's why they call it ADHD.
That's the way the Mayan talk.
Yeah, they accuse me of being hyperactive.
Well, that's what the Mayan, you know, he was telling me. You know, he goes, well, you know, you understand, and in understanding, you understand what not understanding is. And it makes you sad because if people were having and accepting this, here's the best way to look at it. We are spiritual beings living a human existence, not human beings trying to find a spiritual existence. Is that a better way to look at it or to say it? Because if you just accept that you're a spiritual being and you start talking to the Creator and then you start listening and being still and waiting for the Creator to actually nudge you, first he's going to nudge you, and then he's going to start talking to you, or she, depending on what the spirit is. It's just amazing. How do you put that in human words? Amazing.
Well, you know, there have been times when I've heard Creator speaking, and it's a male voice, but as the overtones are female, as it's trailing off, so it's both.
Yeah. Yeah, and then the humor, the divine humor is just bridged. It's better than any Neil Simon, the comedy of life. That's what I look at it now.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's a big comedy. It's a divine comedy. And the irony, and it's funny because people will get hung up on obsessions of the mind until they figure out that it's like a Chinese finger trap. You keep pulling, guess what's going to happen? You're not going to get out of it. Just let go. Let go and let God do it. Guess what? It'll work out.
Yeah, but
they get caught up in I call it the rat hole. They go round and round and round with the same problem.
Yeah.
And they don't solve it because the key is just let go. Hello, plant a seed.
Surrender.
Don't try
surrender.
To grow because it's time to grow. Yeah, you're right. That's the best word. Surrender.
That's what. That's what John Redhead said, and you know our Muslim friends say the same thing, but they. They have a little bit different view of things, and But hey, Mark,
it's so nice
tell him what you told me on Facebook.
Well, we usually look at on the show here. Blue Otter's Mayan birth in traditional day count is a 9 eek, and we have a fairly high number of guests, I'd say some are 50% or more maybe, that usually have a connection to that. And in earlier, you know, when we were talking, we mentioned the one about the dreaming and the focusing in universality and all. Dreaming thing is actually that I was reading, talking about, actually connects back to all the things you're talking about, caves. But that particular day, I'm looking actually at a symbol here of a cycle, and it's a circle. And that circle starts on the day you were born, on the forward flow of time. And it moves around the circle, and then it goes into the center of the circle. And the center of that circle is a 9 eek. So your birth is like the alpha, the beginning of that circle, and Blue Otter's is the 9 eek, the omega, the end of it. So you guys are sitting there, you guys have a very interesting connection. It's talking about basically this connection appears to be related specifically to the stars of the Pleiades. So I would suspect that both of you have a connection going back to the Pleiades, you may even know each other on a spirit level from there.
Oh, we do.
Well, that's what Rolling Thunder.
Very good chance of that.
Yeah, that's what Rolling Thunder told me. He said we've had a lot of migrations. He says, but we came here from the Pleiades.
Yeah.
And,
oh, I know that. That's what Cherokee means, Children of the Stars.
Yeah.
And that's where we came from. You're exactly
so the,
right.
The glyph you were born on is looks like a seed being planted into the ground. It's the Khan glyph, and it looks like a seed. And a lot of people will say that's actually a corn seed. Well,
it is.
You probably know this because one of the Mayan names for the Pleiades is Motz, M-O-T-Z, is the way it's normally spelled, and it means a handful of seeds, and because the Pleiades looks like a bunch of seeds thrown up in the sky. So you're literally born on it. So, yeah, you have a... Now, there is one other thing to hear that may be interesting to you. The same cycle, right before it goes in the center circle, has a glyph. And it's indicating to me that it might be worth your while. There might be some benefit from you to be learning about down in Mexico, if you've ever seen the image of the Lady of Guadalupe, Our Lady of Guadalupe. That particular image is probably will help you in a way, and specifically the image, if you look at it, over her womb, there's a symbol. It looks like a four-petal flower.
Okay.
Well, that four-petal flower symbol has a multitude of meanings, a huge number of meanings. It's too much to go through all of them. But one of them in particular is that it connects to a cave that's at Teotihuacan underneath the Pyramid of the Sun, and that cave is shaped exactly like that, like a four-petal flower. So,
okay.
It seems to me that there's something about that might be helpful for you to learn about and go through the process, maybe just meditating on that particular image and the awareness of that cave. I suspect you could probably just, right before you go to sleep or whenever, you could probably just want to go there to the cave and you'd probably pop over there and get to visit for a
You're
while.
Right.
Yeah.
That's how it works. You know that.
So,
that's the meditation part that I was talking about. You know, you actually can, you know that. You can travel. And it's very possible, but that's a higher
so kind of like
for most people to understand.
Yeah, if someone else saw you traveling, you would probably look like an orb.
Well, you're very true about that. Yes,
yeah.
And so you understand that, but a lot of folks listening might not because they just. Well, they may, and if they do, that's
cool.
Well,
I think we might have a lot of listeners I think that might connect with what you've been talking about. I was going to ask you maybe to talk a little bit more about the orbs and seeing
those.
Okay,
yeah, you want to?
Because I have a feeling that there's maybe some listeners that like to hear about that.
Okay, great. Well, I can do that. Well, let's see. These orbs, they're real. They come and go a lot. Some of them have different energy values. And again, it has to do with some are on higher frequencies, some are on lower frequencies. Some people just call that realms in the Catholic viewpoint. Some people would call that, it is what it is. There's different frequencies, and they appear in different forms. Some of them are not as, they all have beauty. It's again, you have to look through the exterior and look at the interior, and so. Some of them may appear frightening to people, but they're not frightening. It's just that's the way they were made, okay? Just understand that when you look at somebody who may be handicapped, you don't look at the handicap, you look at the heart, okay? So the spirit world the same way. Some of the spirits may not look so beautiful on the exterior. They may even look frightening, but you know what? Look past that because behind that darkness is the bright light. You understand what I'm saying now? If you... fear, then you're going to beget fear, and then it's like a predator in a unless like a predator. If they sense fear in you, they're going to eat you. It's the same thing with the lower vibration. Now, with the higher vibration, it's just sending you a more higher frequency signal. How could you not love? But sometimes with a lower vibration, it's hard to love a lower tone. I guess that's the way to say it. And be correct, or be as correct as I can be. I'm far from being correct about things, since there's only one perfect correctness. And so about the orbs, they come and they go, and they're there a lot, which is the cool part. Because I can take pictures, and I have pictures of them actually hugging me. The mother spirit will come. And it's funny that you say the lady, because the lady comes, and I've seen her in the face before. As a matter of fact, I have a picture of her out here in my backyard last week with some friends of mine who came to get some spiritual validation. We did a big prayer and meditation ceremony here in my backyard. And we had probably 22 orbs around us. Oh, there were so many at one time, it almost looked smoky around here. They were spinning around in circles and running back and forth. And there were, people say shooting stars. Those are shooting stars. Those are orbs at a lower level flying all over the place really quickly. Different ones, blue, orange, it's just amazing. And I can only imagine what a pilot would be seeing when they were flying around and that's going on. I mean, they thought I had to have a stiff drink because it's not something you can explain with any radar. I'm sorry, but it makes me laugh because it is. It's funny because some people's minds just can't handle that. They're like, wow, this is just not real. And so they don't want to believe it, but it is real. It's so real, not so real. So,
yep.
Yes. So that's, again, it had to be in the right, the conditions have to be right is what I'm trying to say. You got to have an open heart, got to have an open mind, and more importantly, you have that sense of being a part of. And so when that happens, those beings sense it. The beings right sense it, and they come right down and they're around, and then they impart knowledge to you, which is kind of neat because it's more of a telepathic type of knowledge. And you'll hear the hum, the frequency, and if you close your eyes and open your ears, you'd be amazed at what comes. And you'll see these images, and these images will come on. And you don't even have to focus. Just close your eyes and just look at the back of your eyes. And these beautiful images will come up. Like, you can see the Buddha. You'll see the Lady Guadalupe. You'll see crosses. You'll see saints. You'll see monks. You'll see knights. You'll see, winged angels. I mean, just, it's amazing. How can I explain?
Well, I remember one time,
wolves.
I was,
I can see wolves. I can see eagles. Everything. It's amazing.
I remember see some of those things too, and I sent out a thought to them. I said, well, if you guys can understand that I'm trying to communicate and stuff with you, then get together and do this and this and this. Well, all of a sudden, a multitude of them actually came together and united and formed a bigger geometric orbital pattern. Right?
Yeah, the Merkaba cube.
So that it was very interesting. So, you can communicate and they react and respond. It reminded me one time of Blue Water, kind of the same thing where he was talking about mainly communicating like with a UFO or something and asking, something, and it responded. He can say more about that.
Oh, yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Oh, I can tell you about the UFO thing. They're real. We see them all the time down here. And yes, they do mentally, especially what some people would call the gray race or whatever. I've seen that happen before with a buddy of mine who's very connected with the people from Vega. And he's got his own Kundalini from that area. Anyway, he's an interesting chap. He's a technology guy, which is kind of neat. Like I said, when we get together, I've got a group of very spiritual people around me, and we get together and get into the prayer, group prayer, group meditation. Have you ever seen Dr. Greer's documentary series on YouTube? That's a really good one to watch. Dr. Stephen Greer. Yeah, man. He understands.
Oh, yeah.
And he knows what it's about. Yeah, which is really neat because, you know, they're all out there underneath stars, meditating, just sending their love out, and boom, look what happens. I mean, that happens a lot. It's all about the universal mind, you know, again, like what we're talking about. You know, openness, open-mindedness, willingness, and just sending the love out there, and you'd be surprised what comes back. It's awesome. yeah, so that's my experience, and I continue to have that experience today. Right now, sitting in my backyard, I can see right now probably three of those orbs around right now, which is kind of neat. But I'm talking, and I'm not listening, so they're just kind of chilling. what more can I say? I'm a blessed man. My life is blessed. I had to go through my trials and tribulations before I could get to that point, and I continually seek. I do as much spiritual stuff as I can. I try to help others in everything that I do. As long as I stay out of myself and let the Creator do the work through me as best possible without me getting in the way, and most of the time that's just being patient and letting the Creator do his job and me not getting in the way, everything else just works out. It's kind of neat. That's actually what I mean. It's awesome. You know, I wouldn't trade this life I have now. It's a life I never dreamed I could have. And, you know, I'm not a wealthy man, nor do I ever wish to be, because that destroyed me many times. I would rather give everything I have away, because the rewards of having a spiritual connection far outweigh any wealth on this planet. But you can't take that stuff with you anyway. Which is kind of neat. Anyway. Anything else you guys will need to know?
No.
Or would like to know? Or want to? Yeah, I mean, I can.
You know, whatever. Well,
I have.
Yeah, just, you know, we got to, you know, stay on as long as you want, or and we've got 2 hours, but we don't have to take it, so, but, yeah, just...
Okay, I don't even know how much time we've spent, Cats. I have no idea. What mark are we at? And then I can go into some other stuff.
We got a half hour of stream to go.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know. I needed to know no time frames, because I kind of lose track of time when I'm having fun. Although my wife doesn't like that very much, because she likes to be validated constantly, which is a good thing, and she's a good woman. I'm being married to a woman who that is not a believer, so that's kind of a good balance for me right now. I mean, she has her own way of looking at things, but she's not at the level where I am maybe right now. So she's more in the material and the self than she is in. You know, it is what it is. It's a good balance, though, because it keeps me grounded, which is a good thing, because if I get my head too high up into the clouds, it's hard for me to come back sometimes. And I start speaking with her with a level she just doesn't understand, and then it creates a spark between us, which is, it doesn't bring peace, it brings chaos. But again, it kind of balances in a way sometimes. I got some wonderful children, very spiritual. I have a son who was diagnosed with autism, and we'll go into that part. And, you know, autism is an interesting thing. It's a spectrum. You know, there's all sorts of theories as to how autism happens. Now, this is my wife. When I prayed and got down on my knees, and I was so desperate that I needed a companion, this is what the Spirit brought me, and she's wonderful, absolutely wonderful. But again, she's a balance, which is awesome. And we have our only child together. She has an older child that calls me dad. And then I have two from my wife that passed away that are identical twins, and they're the ones with the quarter Cherokee blood right now. And then I have my son, Frank. My wife's side of the family is interesting. They're like yours, Will, Swedish. Actually, they're Swedish, Italian, and a couple other things from the New York area. But our son has autism, and he was diagnosed at an early age with autism. And what was interesting is he was a very early walker. He walked at 8 months old, started to point at things when he was 9 months, 10 months old. And then he got his shots at 1 year. He got 5 shots. And after those 5 shots, he became hypotonic. He regressed, wouldn't walk anymore. And right about 18, 19 months old, My wife and I were both in somewhat of a state of denial, and we said, there's something wrong here. We need to go get this checked out. So we went to go see a developmental pediatrician, and we found out that he had mild to moderate autism. Of course, the doctor was quite insensitive. He handed my wife a box of Kleenexes and walked out of the room, said, your child has autism, handed a box of Kleenexes and walked away, which blew me away. I was like, I cannot believe how uncaring this man is. And my wife's heart was just ripped out. And again, awfulizing something that actually turned out to be one of the most beautiful gifts that we both have ever had. Because really, autism is evolution of species. And Zhukov talks about this in the book, Seed of the Soul, about going from five-sensory to multi-sensory. Well, what's the problem with autism? They're sensory beings. As a matter of fact, they're multi-sensory beings. And here's the big kicker with autism. Five-sensory beings can't teach multi-sensory beings because they don't understand it. So then you want to throw meds on these poor kids that understand more than you do at 2 years old. You know what I mean? And you'll know your entire life because they see and hear things you don't. So we figured that out, my wife and I. We're like, you know, Frankie's kind of special. And, you know, we went to go see some higher, some spiritual people. And we're like, no, this is a crystal child, you know. And we were like, a crystal child? We started looking this up. We're like, understand, evolution of species, multi-sensory beings being born into this time. Have you guys heard about that before, the crystal children?
No, I sure haven't.
Okay, check it out sometime. Kind of neat. And again, like I said, the key for me to explain this to a person is if you read Zhukov's book, it explains it. You know, explains the difference between a five-sensory and a multi-sensory being. You know, those of us that grew up as what we would call indigo children, which is the generation in between. The indigo children were starting to be born maybe 100 years ago. This is just a spiritual term, and you know, it's a name, but it's a spiritual development of the being, the human being. And so the indigos were, you know, I guess you would say, let's say you were sixth chakra at one time, and then we went to seven or eight chakra, and now we're nine chakra people, you know, that type of thing. Becoming more and more spiritually in tune, or basically we're able to fine-tune our frequency, you know, the difference between AM and FM, you know, that type of thing. So once we get our chakras aligned, you know, say if we have more chakras than the average person, we have a stronger transmitter than a receiver, or actually receiver and transmitter stronger. It's a better radio. That's the best analogy I can put it. So my son is very autistically inclined. He draws pictures and Zorbs all the time, which is really neat because he sees them too. And when I meditate and he'll go into meditation with me at 7 years old, which is amazing in itself that he can even sit still for that long having autism, which is so cool. He can go places, and it's amazing because he'll go places with me. And he actually teaches me at 7 years old about stuff through his pictures. He'll show me pictures of stuff, and I'll understand what he's seeing in his visions, which is neat. So, and what's really neat is he's been put on a medication by an open-minded physician from Iceland who is just wonderful. I love open-minded physicians who want to learn and stay on top of things, called low-dose naltrexone, which is really neat. We put Frankie on this medicine, and again, this is such a cool medicine, and I like to plug it because it's a lifesaver for a lot of people. I did some work with these guys over in England, and things didn't work out, and blah, blah, blah. But I always like to say that, you know, this is a good medicine. It's actually comes from the opium poppy, and it's an anti-methadone. It's a 13 amino sequence medication. It works in the brainstem and in the cortex and a couple other places. It works on the endocannabinoid systems, which is neat. It works on the oxytocin systems, which is even neater. And what it does is it suppresses, it also works on the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is cortical It also works on the right medial forebrain bundle. It's also an I don't know if you guys understand this neurochemistry, but it also is a opiate blocker, which means it blocks all three opiate receptors that we know about or can study at this time, alpha, mu, and kappa. So basically, it stops pain, but it's not addictive, which is really cool. And, again, it's derived from an opium poppy. And what's really neat is it has this really cool cyclic carbon ring in the shape of a three-dimensional pyramid at the base of it. What an awesome structure to have as a psychoactive compound, a three-dimensional pyramid made out of carbons. It works in the brain. That's cool. So, and what it does is it shuts off for people that have obsessions of the mind, like sex addiction, food addiction, drug addiction, alcohol addiction. It stops desire. It stops craving. It stops the obsession of the mind. Now, that's only one of the great aspects of this medication. The other thing is it's essentially acting inhibitor
of
inflammation. So
let me ask you something.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt,
yeah.
But before my wife was very prophetic before she passed away, and she told me, she said,
yes,
someday you're going to find a natural way to lose weight.
That's it. This does it. Right here. Food addiction. Because people medicate their feelings. That's how they get a food addiction. Oh, yeah, man. This is no joke. You know,
well,
you
interesting.
Let me explain to you something. Yeah.
Interesting thing. A lot of, you know, my second wife said, you know, I married my first wife's best friend, and she died 12 years later. But she said, you know, you really don't eat that much, you know, and I said, well, I gained it all because I was so sick, and Dr. Rogers explained to me you tend to eat fatty foods when you're that ill and can't sleep. But go ahead.
Yeah, but understand that, again, it goes beyond the food addiction, too. It suppresses your desire to it works on refractory depression, okay? It stops the obsessions of the mind. And once again, it works for ADD. It works for depression. It works for PTSD. It's the only thing I've ever seen that works for people that have PTSD. And let me explain to you a little bit something about addiction. Now, I'm an addictionologist per se. I trained with addiction specialists from the American Society of Addiction Medicine. Well, they obviously didn't read Carl Jung, because Carl Jung said that this is all just neurosis living in fear. All right? And that addiction was just a symptom of emotional trauma. Now, who doesn't have emotional trauma when they're a kid? Now, let me explain to you something about emotional pain. Emotional pain to one person, and it's subjective. Here you go. When you're a kid, you could break a shoelace and imprint that into your mind that you did something wrong and live with that for the rest of your life, that you're a lesser than. Or you could be abused as a child, and then that would imprint as you wanting to be abused for the rest of your life, because it's the only way that you feel part of, and you feel lesser than if you're not being abused. That's like a battered wife syndrome. That's emotional pain. You can't tell somebody what their emotional pain is. I'm sorry, you can't do it. They can only, through their own experience, understand what pain is. That's like if two people get a cut on their arm, you got some people that you look at these guys from India, they can stick a sword through their skin and have no pain. Or then you can have somebody gets a little paper cut and they're like, and they'll remember that the rest of their life. Again, it's a subjective experience. That's what the setting is, as Leary described long ago, and many other brilliant minds have. But, again, that emotional pain imprints. And what Jung called this was hyperamnesia. Okay, not amnesia, hyperamnesia, because you imprint it so heavily into your subconscious that it's hard getting it out of there, because once it goes into the subconscious part of the mind, guess what? It's hard to get it up out of there unless you relive it and walk through it, all right? So that's emotional pain. So what this medication does is it unleashes the subconscious. It brings the level of the conscious and the subconscious up to the zero balance point, and it does this through oxytocin mediation in the brainstem. At least that's the theory here. I love some cellular guys to go take a look at this. I think that we'll find out that's right. But I actually had a buddy of mine who's a high school science teacher who knows a whole lot about chemistry. He's brilliant. And he looked at the molecule and he said, yeah, you know something, Doc? We might just be right here. And to hear that from a science guy, it's a hard science guy because, you know, I'm a clinical science guy. I do a little bit of hard science guy, and I just know a little bit about stuff. I'm never, ever going to be an expert. I know that because the more I learn, the less I know. The cool aspect is this medication works for fibromyalgia, works for lupus. It's working for any inflammatory disorder, basically. Don't let me convince you. Go on to YouTube and check out low-dose naltrexone and look at the other 1,000 doctors or more from around the world that have testimonials out there. It's been in clinical trials and been proven to work. But here's the kicker. The patent ran out on this medication a long time ago. So you can treat somebody for $3 or $4 a month, which is beautiful, but doctors won't prescribe it because the only thing it's indicated for in this country, some doctors will, the only thing it's been indicated for in this country is treatment for drug addiction and alcohol addiction at this point. There is one intramuscular preparation of it available, but that's dosed at way too high a dose because, as anything, you have to have the right amount for it to work. And the proper dosage for the medication, according to experts abroad, is 1.5 to 4.5 milligrams a day. That's negligible when it comes to side effects. As a matter of fact, the placebo side effects are worse than the sexual side effect of the medication, which is hilarious when you look at the studies because go find me a study where the medication has less side effect than placebo because good comes out of it. The other thing is there's a doctor, I can't remember his name, he was from New York, and I looked at his study, but he was taking this medication and injecting it into rats that had lymphoma, and the tumors were resolving. So it has some anti-cancer benefits. It also has HIV benefits. And there's also a Dr. Chopra, C-H-O-P-R-A, out of Rhode Island, who's using it for pain management and finding great results with it. Again, because it stops the pain pathways from connecting, where it blocks out pain by blocking the opiate receptors. I'm sure it works in the spinal cord as well because it doesn't just work in one spot. The beautiful part about it is that in autism, all the files are there. The kids just have trouble getting the files out because there's so much sensory going on. Like my son, as long as he has an iPad going, he has no problem focusing because he has something to blot out the rest of the sensory coming in. This medication has allowed him to focus and get things out. And, like, the files come out one at a time instead of all of them trying to come out at once. So he's reading, writing, and doing math now, and he didn't speak up 2 years ago. He was nonverbal 2 years ago. Now he's reading, writing, doing math, which is a miracle in itself.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah, how grateful can you be? Thank you. Thank you, Creator. Awesome. Thanks for dropping another beautiful thing into my lap.
I got a question for you.
Again,
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but is this every 2 or 3 months my wife sees a mental health, I guess she's a PA, and she gets her antidepressant meds. Is this the kind of thing that that this person, what did you say it was indicated for in the pharmacopoeia?
It's for what it's indicated for in this country, based on the studies done by the FDA, is opiate addiction and alcohol addiction now.
Okay.
And remember what I told you about addiction. Addiction is only a symptom. The addiction guys got that wrong. It's a symptom of an underlying disease. And the underlying disease process, or I don't even call it disease process, it's just living in fear. As Carl Jung said, and his two essays on psychoanalysis, if you read Jung, don't read the Cliff Notes, read what he wrote. He studied nurses, and nurses that were drinking and drugging because of having to deal with other people's emotional pain all the time. You understand emotional pain spreads like a virus. If you're around people that have emotional pain, you get it from them, okay? So
tell me about it.
If you put a person with PTSD into a family that's healthy, they're all going to get codependent, what they call codependency. No, they're just going to catch the emotional pain from them and have their own emotional pain from dealing with the person. You should understand how the emotional pain is, it's spreadable like a virus. And so if you don't have healthy relationships with people, they become dysfunctional because somebody becomes an enabler, somebody becomes a hero, somebody becomes a mascot, somebody becomes a scapegoat. You know, they all become dysfunctional in the way that they interact instead of having healthy relationships with boundaries. You understand that part now? So this medicine stops that. It stops the desire in the brainstem. It blocks central inflammation, again. And we might even take this even to the easiest way to explain this. There are two parts of our nervous system in the brainstem. There's a sympathetic and parasympathetic. Sympathetic is a fight or flight. That's the, you know, drop everything and run. Okay, that's the sympathetic. Then you've got the parasympathetic, which is what we call the autonomic. That's the one that runs your heart, your blood pressure, and keeps you all mellow and chill. Everything's good. It's good all the time. So it switches you from the drop everything and run to everything's okay. And that's what it does. There's a switch in the brainstem that makes the sympathetic, and that's the fear, you know, that's the fight or flight, the fear instinct, or the desire, or I need this because I don't feel okay, you know, the hyperactive part, to where you just go, oh, everything's all good. And I've seen people and heard testimonials and seen people that have doctors that are open-minded that have prescribed this to them, where they've had refractory depression that are skipping around like they're 20 years. I know an 82-year-old man that's on this medication. He's a Lockheed Martin engineer, and he will tell you to this day it changed his life. And he had an open-minded enough physician to go onto the Internet and take a look at this stuff and actually try it with him. Yeah, man.
Are you saying naltrexone?
Yeah, naltrexone.
Gotcha. Okay. I had the wrong thing. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Naltrexone. I've got a friend
in Houston who's she's a psychologist and she deals with addictions, and I'm cluing her into what's going on and might help her in her practice.
It will. And you know what? Give it a chance. You know, try it for a month and tell me if you don't see results, because you will. I guarantee it. Now, remember, it's the body, mind, and spirit. So, again, this is just the body part, okay? This clears up the body, does the mind, but they got to get the spiritual angle, too. You know, you have to understand that, you know how that works. And so you got to believe in the medication. You got to believe in the higher power that's going to help you. And whatever that higher power, whatever your conception of that higher power is, that's your own individual path to enlightenment, you know? So what I always tell people is that, you know, this is just one leg of it. This is not all of it. You got to exercise, okay? You have to eat right. You have to, it goes back to purity, you know? Try to be pure of the mind, body, and spirit, the purity part. And again, nobody's perfect, but do your best. And you'll notice that when I do all the things that I'm supposed to do, take care of this body, because this is just a rented spacesuit that I got on right now. Okay, that's really the way I look at it. I got to keep my spacesuit healthy. Okay, so how do I do that? I don't eat meat. I eat vegetables. I exercise. I drink spring water. You know, I do all these good things for my body, and guess what? It's nice back to me. And then the mind, I read TV once in a blue moon. I'll watch a movie, but it's got to be on something that will be stimulating to my mind, not put me to sleep. And I do some documentaries every now and then. But the majority of my stuff I read. I really enjoy reading. My kids think I'm strange because I'm constantly have a book in my hand, but that's the way I learn best. Some people like audiobooks, but I like to listen to enlightened people. I read Goethe. I read, stuff from all over. I read Eastern religion, Western religion, archaeology, history books, and not new books, old books. I try to seek out older books and look at things from like 1820, 1850, 1880, 1700s, if you can find stuff like that. Or I look at Gnostic texts. Different things, you know, because little pieces are there, little pieces, and they just come to you, and there's such profound writing out there, And that's not to downplay anything written today, okay, because there's good stuff out there today. Personally, I find more knowledge in older stuff myself because it connects dots.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Back before Big Pharma just totally corrupted doctors.
Oh yeah. Well, I have my great grandfather's medical books from the 1890s, and guess what? They're not much different than the ones today. As a matter of fact, they have stuff in there we don't have in there today. So I go back to the old books. It's kind of neat, man. It's very, very neat. And remember, I don't like to judge anything. It is what it is. But it was allowed to happen because people let it happen. And they weren't willing to say, hey, there might be something, a better way. I just look at it. So I look at things solution-based nowadays. What's the solution? Don't get caught into the problem. So I turned a blind eye to it. It's not, if I fight something, it's better just to surrender to it. And guess what? If I surrender to it, it has no power over me. You understand that part of it? To stay truly powerless and in true surrender, I won't engage it. Because if I engage it, it gets power over me, and I don't want that. So why would I engage something? Why would I want to take power and energy away from me when I could be using it to help somebody?
Question.
Does that make sense to you? Well,
sure. Did you ever hear of Dr. George Starr White?
No, sir. You know, I'm very limited as to my with people in the medical.
Yeah, Dr. Rogers will be talking with you about George Starr White. Okay. That's
okay.
He's... Go ahead. I hate to say this, but I just looked at the clock and we got to go. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We're running out of time. So, it's been fun.
I'll tell you guys. Yeah, and you know something? I'd love to do this again. I have some really cool spiritual friends that you all might want to talk to. I have a genius in batteries technology and electronical engineering who works with myself and our new company. We are designing some stuff that's going to change the way we do medicine if we can get it to happen. I'd like to, if you want to hear about the future of telecommunications and medicine, I got a guy to talk about that, and I also have an engineer from Lockheed who's, like I said, he's 82, brilliant, brilliant man who he's a Zen master, let's just put it that way. He's one of my good friends. I have all these wonderful spiritual people around me. I'm so blessed, and including you all, and I'm so glad to have you. I'm honored at your friendship. I'm honored at your brotherhood. And how can I ever help you? You just ask. And I'm so grateful for everything in this life, in this world. That's the only thing I can truly say is, what can I do for you, my Creator? What can I do? Just tell me.
Well, we're gonna have some fun together. You know? We'll hook you up with Dr. Pagan down in Peru, and a bunch of really interesting people. Listen, got to run. I got to roll the outro music, and we'll be in touch, okay?
All right. Bless you all.
Thanks a lot.
Good day.
Hey, good night
forward.
Now.
All right.
Be talking to you real soon.
You too.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Join us to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Friends, this is your co-host, Will Blue Otter. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Blue Otter, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
Grandfather, teach me the ways of the old, so that I may remember.